BBC.
BBC.
You're with the BBC. Now in the BBC World Service, to reflect the dramatic events in Egypt, we've got a profile of the former weapons inspector who some now hope will become Egypt's new leader. Mukul Devichand asks, who is Mohamed El-Baradei?
Egypt has for days been teetering on the edge of chaos. What began as a peaceful mass protest against the 30-year rule of President Hosni Mubarak has turned into a series of pitched battles on the streets of the country's main cities. For one man, the events of last Wednesday were a turning point. The government struck back. Pro-Mubarak supporters, some of them armed, clashed directly with those who want the government to go. Blood was spilled. Several people were killed, and more than 1,500 taken to hospital for treatment. It was precisely what the immaculately dressed, quiet man, who had become the most prominent demonstrator of all, had been preaching against.
The government, the regime, should respect the right of people for peaceful demonstration.
Mohamed El-Baradei, the softly spoken former United Nations weapons inspector, now the focal point for many of the demonstrators.
They are expressing through their peaceful demonstration their need, legitimate need, for Egypt that is democratic, that based on social justice. And the regime has not been listening. And I think we tried in so many ways to make the regime understand that change is inevitable, that change has to come.
Dr. El-Baradei has spent much of the last few months in Austria, but returned to Egypt a week ago, and in a public show of common cause with the protesters, took part very publicly in Friday prayers. The BBC's reporter Yolanda Nell was also there.
Well, what I saw, I wasn't so far away from Mohamed El-Baradei. He's a very distinctive face, of course, was visible among the crowds. When people saw him, they started to close in on him. People, I think, have been quite desperate for some kind of a leading figure for these protests. There were some people very supportive of him, shouting out as soon as they saw him. And I think people were worried about the crush. He was moved, I saw, into the main gates of the mosque, taken away from the violence as it began to unfold with the riot police not far away. He's generally avoided direct confrontation with the regime, with the government here, the regime as he calls it, and he's put out a lot of supportive messages this week, but this was his first really big public appearance, and he wasn't able to be seen for long.
That was a week ago. In the intervening days, he's made more and more appearances. He's something of a reluctant figurehead, but with Egypt's opposition deeply fragmented as a result of President Mubarak's autocratic rule, Dr. El-Baradei is the only personality so far to have emerged as someone around whom the protesters can coalesce. Salah Fadl, who organised a speaking tour to London for Dr. El-Baradei last year, describes him as a key figure.
The problem is that after 30 years of oppressive, non-democratic regime of Mr. Mubarak, the opposition is left in shambles. The political parties have been weakened beyond belief. They're all divided. They all, strangely enough, agree on the basics. And Mr. Baradei has helped over the past year to focus their minds on the essential requirements or conditions of change. Democracy, constitutional change, free elections, and so on.
And until now, he's done that in a calm, measured language. But the events of Wednesday seem to have angered him deeply. The protesters in central Cairo suddenly found themselves confronted head-on by their opponents. Violence, he said, was inevitable. Dr. El-Baradei pointed the finger at the police, saying this should never have been allowed to happen.
This is yet another symptom or another indication of a criminal regime using criminal acts. You know, everybody has the right for peaceful demonstration, but you don't get two opposing demonstrators face to face. I mean, then you are calling for violence. My fear is it will turn into a bloodbath, and particularly that we know that the guys who are supposedly so-called pro-Mubarak are a bunch of thugs. It seems to me that this is a regime that does not want to listen to the people, does not want to understand that they need to go, and it in fact strengthen the resolve of every Egyptian that Mr. Mubarak has to go.
There's a clear, marked difference in tone and language.
Maghdi Abdelhadi, the BBC's Arab Affairs analyst, who's also now in Cairo.
When he first came back to Egypt after finishing his term at the International Atomic Energy Agency, he was very diplomatic. He avoided mentioning Mubarak, and he said, this is not about persons, this is about politics and policies, and we may disagree, but I don't want to talk about Mubarak. But on Wednesday, when he spoke about the latest developments and the violence in Tahrir Square, the language has become very, very tough and sharp and directed at Mubarak himself. And that is a very, very big difference from the language used by al-Baradei when he first returned to Egypt over a year ago.
So who is Mohamed al-Baradei? What pushed him from a life of comfortable post-diplomatic retirement into the very centre of the Arab world's chaotic moment of transformation? Well, let's wind back to last year. Dr. al-Baradei has just left his post as Director General of the UN's nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA. I'm in a London University lecture theatre that's full to brimming with a very excited crowd of Egyptian expats. And they're here to witness, in a sense, the rebirth of Dr. Mohamed al-Baradei. He's only just started speaking, but what's striking is just how quiet Dr. Mohamed al-Baradei is in style. In this fiery, politically charged room, he sounds pensive, very, very careful. It's already quite an unusual story, the Nobel Prize-winning diplomat turned political reformer in his old age. But it all makes you wonder what's really going on in his mind.
People have got a lot of hope for him because he's actually been able to hold such a critical position.
Well, I think it's the first time that I've seen someone who's a viable alternative to the current regime.
Baradei is representing a great hope and a good step for a change.
But Dr. al-Baradei's face was most famous from his countless TV appearances in the run-up to the Iraq War, in his role as an impeccable UN weapons inspector.
We would like Iraq to show cooperation by providing evidence that they no longer have weapons of mass destruction in terms of documents.
The thing that I most recall about my dealings with Dr. al-Baradei and observing in his dealings with others was the stature that he brought to the post and the respect in which he was held. So he has a sort of magisterial bearing and authority that went with that.
Jack Straw was British Foreign Secretary during the episode that propelled Dr. al-Baradei into the international spotlight, the run-up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003. In that time of dodgy dossiers about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, Straw remembers him as a far shrewder and more measured diplomat than Hans Blix, his fellow weapons inspector who stood alongside him in the UN Security Council on the eve of war.
Well, he plainly had views about the matter. It was highly controversial what we should do about Iraq. He was, however, able better to detach his own views, and because of that, he was treated with perhaps more respect and accord than Hans Blix.
Well, the US tell me their perceptions, the British tell me their perceptions, the Russians, the Chinese, Timbuktu. I mean, everybody tell me their perception. At the end of the day, I write my own perception. You need to learn to deflect pressure.
Dr. al-Baradei had become famous for his independence of mind, defending the peaceful nuclear programs of non-Western countries, or dismissing US claims that Niger was selling uranium to Iraq. So was the careful career diplomat always a political animal? Those who know him best describe a very intense, emotional core that drives his diplomacy. His daughter, Laila al-Baradei, is a London-based lawyer.
I recalled one instance where my brother and I were watching a DVD of Finding Nemo, the Disney fish movie. My dad started watching it with us, and he was really, really upset by it, even though we assured him there would be a happy ending.
Some of the areas in which he's worked, like nuclear inspection, are things which you hope would have happy endings, but could have quite dark endings.
Yeah, I mean, I think for him, the Iraq war was the ultimate tragic ending, really. And I know that the day the war was launched was a very, very dark day for him personally.
An emotional heart encased in a judicious exterior. It runs in the family. Mohammed El-Baradei was born on June 17, 1942, son of another famous lawyer, Mustafa El-Baradei, a president of Egypt's Bar Association, known for defending civil liberties. Mohammed El-Baradei studied law in Cairo and abroad, and then joined his young nation's foreign service, aged 22. In this more idealistic age of third world unity, he served in Geneva and then New York, where he met lifelong friend Nabih El-Arabi.
One thing I can tell you about him is that even from that young age, he knew what he wanted and he worked for it. He was not the run-of-the-mill person who will just go around doing what everyone else is doing. I mean, if we were all going out and something he doesn't like, he will not go and he will start reading more. He was studious all his time.
Dr. El-Baradei may have been studious, but he found time to relax at home with his two children and wife Ada, a kindergarten teacher. His daughter says his Manhattan years infused him with a lifelong love of the distinctively American humour of Woody Allen and Seinfeld. In 1980, he left the Egyptian Foreign Service to teach law and work at the UN again in New York. He later transferred to Vienna to work in the UN's nuclear watchdog, the IAEA. But when I asked his press officer there, Melissa Fleming, whether he regaled his co-workers with Seinfeld jokes, she said, not at all.
He's very formal. He has beautiful tailored suits. He had a lovely office on the 28th floor that overlooked the Danube. Hanging on the walls were a lot of modern art that he picked out himself during his travels. There was also the Edvard Munch painting of the screaming man. I think this painting was there to express his frustration so that he didn't have to do it himself.
Until this point, Dr. El-Baradei had been a textbook career civil servant, the rare internal candidate who worked his way up to director general. But all that changed when it became clear that the United States wanted to go to war with Iraq. Dr. El-Baradei challenged the logic of war until the very end, saying Iraq had long since abandoned its nuclear weapons programs. As the BBC's diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus recalls, the growing importance of the IAEA resulted in increased tension.
It's often forgotten that the IAEA has a dual role, and I think Dr. El-Baradei was very conscious of this. It isn't just there to be a nuclear policeman. It is actually an agency which is there to promote the peaceful uses of nuclear technology around the world. And I think it was interesting because the growing prominence of the organisation inevitably brought it face-to-face with the Bush administration in the United States. Dr. El-Baradei was not a supporter of the invasion of Iraq, very clearly, and he steered a very careful and independent course for the IAEA, much to the annoyance, great annoyance, of the Americans. The US administration tried to have him removed on at least one occasion, if not more. They failed. And as a mark, I think, of the independence and the growing significance of the agency's role, he and the agency obviously were awarded a Nobel Peace Prize.
Throughout all of this, no one I spoke to ever saw him let his guard down in public or private. Until 2005, when his daughter Laila remembers him receiving the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo.
When the chairman of the Nobel Prize Committee came on stage and delivered a tribute to my father, I know that my father switched the setting on his headset to Norwegian so he wouldn't understand what was being said about him, because he was just very humbled and overwhelmed by the whole experience.
Why do you think he found it so emotional to be recognized in that way?
I think he had been doing a very difficult job, a thankless job, as he often describes it, and he had been under an enormous amount of pressure from many different sides.
These years of political brinkmanship had also seen the careful career lawyer himself transformed. Communications Chief Melissa Fleming.
He was extremely shy when I first joined. In a way, over these years and the outside events that were so formative in the world that the IAEA became central to, also were transformative in his life. Having come from somebody who'd never once you know, spoken to a journalist, to someone who the world media was seeking on a day-to-day basis, was a major, major transformation. And then he began to actually even like it.
Melissa Fleming wasn't the only one to notice the change in Mohamed El Baradei. Back home, Egypt, the homeland he'd long since left, had been ruled by the same strongman president, Hosni Mubarak, for almost 30 years. University students there started a Facebook group asking Dr. El Baradei to come home and lead them when Mubarak's rule came to an end. A reported 200,000 people signed up.
He doesn't seem at all like a political leader. The first impression is that he's modest, he's shy.
Professor Hassan Nafa spoke to me from Cairo. He's from the National Movement for Change, the reformers who adopted Dr. El Baradei when he returned to Egypt. When he first got off the plane last year, his unblemished reputation meant he was seen as a lightning rod for popular support by Egypt's weakened liberals. But then he seemed to fall out of favour somewhat.
He might give the impression, even, I'm sorry to say it, but a little bit arrogant in a way. Certainly he wants that Egypt change, and he is certainly willing to do something to help. But I am not quite sure that he is ready to pay the price.
Events have moved fast. Only 2 weeks ago, despite the toppling of President Ben Ali in Tunisia, President Mubarak in Egypt was apparently an immovable force. As we've heard, Dr. El Baradei's voice has been loud and clear in its criticism of the president. But at the same time, few people think he's a permanent solution to the current turmoil. Salah Fadl, who organised Dr. El Baradei's London trip, also remembers his return to Egypt a year ago.
There was a hysteria in Egypt about Baradei. Everybody was talking about him, and when he came first time to Cairo, many Egyptians came to the airport to see him. People traveled from afar to meet him. There was enormous interest in him, unbelievable. And I, for one, thought that if he actually toured the country at that time, he would have actually become the president de facto. And I think, sadly, he missed that window of opportunity in a big way. The reason for that is that Mr. Baradei is not a populist. He's not a man who goes out in the streets and all that. And he was very cautious not to ruffle the regime's feathers at that time. And from then onwards, people wanted to see more of him, and he wanted to see less of them. So that support has kind of dwindled a bit. So now that he has come back to Egypt, some of that popular support is now kind of watchful position, slightly hopeful but slightly doubtful.
Dr. El Baradei is a reluctant leader at best. He's consistently said he doesn't want the job of president. And given the lack of any means of measuring public opinion in Egypt, it's not actually clear how much popular support he really has. Magdi Abdelhadi, the BBC's Arab Affairs analyst.
There are so many people who adopted El Baradei. He really never intended to become the political leader that circumstances in Egypt have more or less made him into. And primarily he was adopted by young idealist people, middle class, educated to speak foreign languages, of course, and eventually by a larger, shall we say, public, primarily liberal intelligentsia and middle and upper middle classes. He's a dream candidate. If you look at his CV, he looks like he looks the part. But in reality, given the nature of politics in Egypt, many people quickly came to the conclusion, maybe he's a nice guy, but he's not really, he hasn't got what it takes to become a political leader. He may inspire some people, but actually rally the crowds and enthuse people to go in one direction or the other, he doesn't look like this.
And Dr. El Baradei himself would probably agree. But his reluctance to step forward may yet be trumped by what appears to be his unwavering sense of public duty. In an emotional interview with the BBC on Wednesday, in which he inveighed against the violence of those he called Mubarak's thugs, he was asked once again whether he would consider leading the opposition.
I have no interest in holding any position. I mean, what I am here for as an Egyptian is to make sure at this stage of my life that Egypt is turned from a repressive authoritarian regime into a democracy. That is That is my first priority. However, if people want me to do whatever I can, I will not let them down. If I can be an agent for change, if I can help in whatever I can do, I will obviously not do it, because this is the least I owe to the people of Egypt.
There's one group of Egyptians in particular that Dr. El-Baradei would have to convince: the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamist party, of whom it's often said that if a proper election were held in Egypt, they might emerge as the biggest party. Muslim Brotherhood leaders have in the past said Dr. El-Baradei might be suitable for a transition period. But is that still the case? One of their senior members, Dr. Abdelmanim Abdel Fattou, speaking from Cairo this week, remained non-committal.
We cannot say we shall support anyone now. We need democracy for our state. We need free election to occur in Egypt, which the free election did not happen from 1952 in Egypt. In such time, if Dr. Baradei or others of Egyptian have the right to introduce themselves as a candidate in a presidential election, in that time, we may give our votes to this or this or this according to his program.
In the short term, at least, however, someone like Dr. El-Baradei is appealing to the Western world, which has found itself somewhat embarrassed in recent days, as its 30 years of support for the autocratic President Mubarak has been exposed to the glare of public scrutiny. And as the BBC's diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus points out, Dr. El-Baradei's biggest fights were with the Bush administration.
This history of bad relations, if you like, between Dr. El-Baradei and the US government, it's an interesting one, and it's one that's very, very relevant to the current predicament. And it's interesting that the Obama administration has tried to begin to grapple with him. What's fascinating, I think, is that very early on in Mr. Obama's tenure, Dr. El-Baradei was very clearly a supporter of Mr. Obama. And it's going to be very interesting, because whilst there's been a lot of bad blood in the past, I think to some extent that bad blood does not extend clearly to this Democratic administration. And of course, what's interesting in the wider sense is the battles that Dr. El-Baradei had very, very publicly with the Americans have clearly not done him any harm in the Arab world, and certainly not in Egypt itself.
It's a sign of the stifling, suffocated nature of Egyptian politics that the person who has emerged as a figurehead is a shy, retiring lawyer with no direct political experience. Dr. Mohamed El-Baradei may or may not ever become president, but that he will play a key role in the coming months seems inescapable.
That was Mukul Devachand. The producer was Tim Mansell.